Hey, y'all, welcome to Gadfly, the podcast about third parties, French candidates, and generally weird American electoral history. I'm Dusty Wilson.
I'm Una O'Leary.
Hey, man, we got to get into it just quick today, you know, because it's Eugene Debs, and the man can't stop, won't stop, probably should stop. And
yeah, we're Deb in here, we're Deb in there.
It's, oh my God, I'll let it slide. So when we last left Eugene Debs, things could have probably been better. So he just recently gotten forced into running for president for the second time. He also got roped into a murder trial, which distracted him from the anarcho-syndicalist takeover of the latest and most historically successful union he created, the IWW.
Yeah, these are dark days for Eugenie Debs.
Oh, man. If these are the dark days.
Oh, no.
Oh, my.
Oh, no.
Yeah, we're just getting into weird days. I think from here on out, Gene gets weird days.
Excellent.
So, I do apologize because for the first half of this, the amount of history information I could find about a campaign in 1908, there isn't a ton of him actually on the campaign trail. And you think there kind of would be because once we get into it. So I apologize that a decent amount of the information is just talking about attendance stats and things like that. So I'm going to try my best to make that interesting, but
one of our listeners is an attendance stats nerd, and
oh my God, yes,
this is for you, listener.
Also, as a heads up, towards the end of the episode there is talk about self-harm. So big heads up on that. It'll be like way towards the end, but yeah, just a heads up on that, giving you a fair warning on that. So I will I'll give a double warning when we're actually coming up on it. So yeah, it's 1908, which can only mean one thing. Someone has to force Eugene to run for president all over again.
Woohoo!
At least that would be the normal plan. The problem this time is that the factional split in the Socialist Party was about to hit a milestone. One side was now strong enough to try for a little bit of a power move. Now, as a bit of a reminder, there is a left wing in the Socialist Party and a right wing in the Socialist Party.
Naturally.
At this point, the Socialist Party, the left wing is controlled by Big Bill Haywood, who's one of the co-founders of the IWW and was one of the people who almost got put to death on a trumped up murder charge in Idaho.
Ooh.
So Haywood and the left wanted the party to focus on bringing in unskilled workers, focused on the ununionized and get them in unions, and on farmers who had mostly been abandoned after the agrarian movement sputtered to a halt back in the late 1800s. On the right, you have what they refer to themselves as the triumvirate, which is never a great sign because the only other triumvirate killed each other until one was all powerful.
When you start to sound like a YA novel from the 2010s?
Yes. So this trio is made up of Morris Hillquit, who is the leader of the New York City right-wing movement, Victor Berger, who you might remember from the last episode as being revealed as extraordinarily racist, to the point that he very much believes in eugenics and believes that there is a race that is better than all the other races.
And it's the amazing race here on NBC.
Daytona 500, motherfucker. It is the best race.
The Mans. Let's go.
I'll give you Le Mans. I'll give you that. Yes. And so Victor Berger controls all of Wisconsin, but is based out of Milwaukee. And then you have J. Malin Barnes, who controlled Pennsylvania with an iron fist. And he is most notable for kicking out anyone from the party who either displeased him or challenged his authority. So, of course, he was the leader from Pennsylvania and the main delegate coming out of there. So the right wing wanted to focus on craft unions, which, you know, as a reminder from past episodes, craft unions is when certain specific craft work within an industry is represented themselves as a union instead of like the entire industry. So in the railroad industry, that'd be the firemen, the conductors, instead of joining a union that's everyone in the railroads.
Is that kind of how it shook out in Hollywood? I mean, we call them guilds, like the Writers Guild, the producer. But
yeah, quite a bit. Yeah. IATSE and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. But Eugene had spent quite a lot of his career, you know, trying to get rid of the craft unions because it caused classism, people to be pitted against each other by the businesses. And then out of nowhere, the right wing is like, no, we need to bring back craft unions. They also wanted to attain reform voters, or at least in the leftist world of the Socialist Party, moderates. That would be like them trying to reach over and be like, we need to get the normie vote who just want government reform.
Normcore vote 1908.
You were going to say Normcore Vore, which... check your computer, Una. I'm sorry.
Oh, no.
It's also notable that the split was along the lines of wage earners on the left and intellectuals on the right. On the left, you had union men that Eugene had brought along, while on the right, there were lawyers, writers, and people who seemed really excited on making a career out of this whole socialism thing. So when the party delegates met in Chicago, the leftists still had a majority and were able to keep things mostly under control. That said, that didn't stop Berger from leading a charge to ensure that Eugene Debs did not win the nomination. And I mean, there was one decent argument about Debs not getting it, and that's that his health was just completely wrecked. By this point, he's dealing with chronic headaches due to a sunstroke that he suffered at one point, arthritis, lower back pain, or lumbago, as it used to be called.
Oh, yeah.
So that's one of the major arguments. The other is that Eugene nearly ruined the party by creating the IWW. And this particularly struck Berger big because he had fought very, very hard to try to get the AFL on the Socialist Party side, but the AFL was in bed with the Democratic Party. And he still wanted to be able to get that inroad to maybe eventually, you know, get the AFL on their side. So the health question ends up getting brought up during the convention, and people are understandably worried. But up next to speak was Ben Hanford, who was Eugene's VP nominee in 1904. And he read a letter from Eugene expressing, once again, that he did not want to run for president. But if you're going to make me, my health is fine. And this led the convention to turn on Berger, and 80% of the vote voted for Eugene once again.
Damn.
And Hanford was once again chosen to be his VP. So we're rewinding it back. It wasn't a complete loss for the right wing, though, because it turns out, and I didn't realize this, the convention votes on who your campaign manager is going to be.
No, no.
And they picked J. Malin Barnes to be his campaign manager.
What?
Yep. And look, I honestly thought this was going to be a perfect chance for some factional skullduggery to screw over Eugene. But I think they know that if they did that, they'd only be like cutting off their nose to spite their face. And from what I could tell, Barnes did a perfectly fine job, all things considered. In fact, he actually created what would become the greatest symbol of Debs's 1908 campaign. The story goes that Barnes arrived to a campaign meeting and rather sheepishly brought up an idea that he barely was even in support of himself. The pitch was that the campaign would rent a train and a sleeper car. They would paint it red, and they would take the train on a nationwide tour where each night they'd stop at a major city, they'd stop at all the little towns in between, and Eugene would give speeches along the way. And they would name the train the Red Special.
Ooh!
Everyone else thought it was a dumb idea, mainly because the cost of the train and the tour would cost the campaign $20,000, or $675,000 in today's money.
Okay, but that's well, I mean, we're living in a post-Citizens United world, so...
Right. Money's a little easier to come by, but even comparing it to modern campaigns right now, there are not a lot of people who have this kind of cash lying around.
Fair, yes.
And especially for a party that hates capitalism, it's going to be a little tough to get that money. So everyone hated the idea, but somehow at the end of the meeting, everyone came around and said, fuck it, let's do it.
Hell yeah. I mean, if nothing else, you got to use that title before it becomes a slur in 1950.
Yeah, that guy's a real Red Special, if you know what I mean. So it's a daunting amount of money to raise in a short period of time. But Bill Haywood and Eugene Debs hit the speaking circuit and started to haul in as many donations as they could. And it's kind of alluded that these two guys are the whole reason that they were able to raise the money. And they did so through small increment donations, with the largest being a donation of $200, which was well off the average. Meanwhile, Gene kept on his speaking tour while they were getting all the funds together. And one of the more notable events came in July when Gene visited Milwaukee. And thanks to Victor Berger living there, it was set to be a raucous crowd. More importantly, Gene was set to be interviewed by highly respected journalist Lincoln Steffens for a series on all the presidential nominees. The interview was held in Victor Berger's home, which, funny enough, led to Lincoln Steffens having to interview both Eugene and Victor at the same time.
It's a BOGO.
I mean, sure. So for me, the two men were fairly different. From Eugene, you know, you get the blunt and jovial honesty that made Deb so famous to begin with. And from Victor, you got very practiced and polished answers that one would expect from a future leader of a party, perhaps. One of the bigger moments in the interview, though, came when Lincoln flat out told Eugene that he didn't think he was a good fit for president. And unsurprisingly, Eugene agreed. Quote, when socialism is on the verge of success, the party will nominate an able executive and a clear-headed administrator. Not me.
Oh, Eugene, no. You're the leader we don't deserve.
It's incredibly true. I do also feel like in this moment, because even though Victor Berger is actively trying to ruin Eugene, Eugene still loves the man for introducing him to socialism to begin with and can't bring himself to say anything bad about the guy. So this moment really feels like he's teeing it up for Victor to be like, you know, when I'm not running, maybe Victor here is going to be a good call. You should listen to what he has to say. He's a polished dude.
He seems real polished.
Yeah.
He knows seems like he wants this.
It's definitely, he wants a little too much, but what are you going to do? So yeah, so after Eugene says he's probably not going to be president, he followed this up by saying the party had no hopes of winning in 1908. And Eugene's goal was to continue to educate workers on socialism and implored he only wanted votes from people who were all in on socialism. I don't want a protest vote. I don't want people who are like, hey, he's probably the lesser of three evils. He's like, no, you are all in on socialism or you do not vote for me.
Yeah, this is not a joke vote.
Right. You're not like screaming at your dad that you're voting for Eugene Debs then storming out of the parlor.
Man, I wish more third parties today acted like this.
Right. It would be so fucking refreshing. Like Cornel West isn't out there like, I'm not going to win. So here's the things I'm trying to convince people of and why I'm running.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Victor stayed quiet throughout all of these answers, which I'm sure made him boil inside. Like, don't tell people we're not going to win in 1908. They won't vote for us. Don't tell moderates not to vote for us. It's just fuck.
You idiot. This isn't how any of this is done.
Did you not read the boring book I got you about this? What do you mean, no? At one point, Lincoln Steffens asked Eugene how he would go about making monopolies publicly owned, because that was one of the big things. If there is a monopoly, then the socialists will seize those companies and the government will own them. So when asked how he was going to do this, Eugene simply replied, quote, I will take them. But yeah, if you're not going to win, you don't need to make a ridiculous plan. Just say you're going to do it.
Yeah. Honesty, people.
So Victor has had enough at this and he immediately interjects and he says, quote, no, you wouldn't. Not if I was there. And you shall not say it for the party. It is my party as much as it is your party. And I answer that we would offer to pay.
My God, where's the Neil Simon play on these two?
Look, I mean, I don't think Neil Simon is a man that I would trust to bring on a carefree dude who talks plainly and a racist attention whore. Like the first half, yes. The second half makes it a little, it's like if Oscar was a racist. I think that's about as close as you could get.
So we're giving this to Norman Lear. Got it.
Yes. Yes, we are. But I do think that Eugene needs to call Victor Berger a crumb bum at some point.
Yeah.
So after the interview, Lincoln wrote positively about Debs, and in private, he tried to get as many people as he could to vote for him. As for Victor contradicting Gene, nothing would really ever come of this, which seems to have empowered Berger to push harder. But we're going to get to that in the future. One of the details I almost wrote down, but I really couldn't figure out a good way to or where to put it, is that the one thing that Eugene Debs could not handle whatsoever was confrontation between friends. He would just kind of close up and refuse to take sides. For instance, his wife, Kate Metzel, hated his brother, Theodore. She thought he was a freeloading sack of shit. She was like a shrew holding Eugene back, and they both openly hated each other.
Wow.
And Eugene shut down and ignored them whenever they were talking about each other and didn't take anyone's side. As I've said before, great husband. So we're going to ignore all that for now because it is fancy choo-choo time, motherfuckers. And the Red Special is ready to pull out of wherever the fuck Union Station was in Chicago at the time. It might have just been built. I don't remember. The plan was the train is going to leave August 31st, head towards San Diego, go north to Spokane, Washington, and then return to Chicago on September 25th. And before the train even left the station, the Socialist Party got one of the top third party achievements. They officially had the Democrats and Republicans freaked out. Because, I mean, $25,000 is a hell of a lot of money to raise at the time, especially in 3 months. But how the fuck does a party get that kind of scratch while also hating capitalism? And this was the basis for the first round of accusations. I haven't brought him up before, but he's definitely a big, I wouldn't say he's an arch enemy of Eugene's. He's definitely a guy who considers Eugene to be an arch enemy and Eugene considers to be awesome guy.
Yeah.
But Samuel Gompers is the guy's name. He's the founder and creator of the AFL, the rival union to the IWW. And Sam Gompers decided that he was going to begin the first round of rumors against the Socialist Party, and that he accused them of taking money from the Republican Party to fund the train. The Socialists immediately responded to this by making all campaign donations public, which instantly proved Gompers wrong. The downside, though, is if you make these things public, you have to rely on people printing that information. And a lot of major press was either owned by the Republicans or the Democrats or hated socialists.
Oh, no.
So the rumor gets to stick a little bit.
No.
The other accusation came that the Socialist Party was actually being funded by foreign nations, most notably Germany, because a lot of people in the Socialist Party spoke German as their first language. Once again, if you looked at the donations, you find that 70% came from people born in America, 20% came from immigrants living in America, and the final 10% is kind of a question mark because Ray Ginger didn't note where that came from. So I'm assuming those are contributions from outside the country, which nowadays would be very illegal. I do find it interesting, though, that they're being hit with the sort of accusations that a lot of modern third parties get today, that they are foreign funded, and that other parties are purposely giving them money to throw the election.
Right. They're just, yeah, these are just spoiler campaigns for the other party of the party accusing, etc.
Yeah, I love that Eugene, even before the train ride starts, has already said, I just want pure socialist votes. No protests, no spoiling. You know, if you vote for me, fucking mean it.
But then again, I do not want to do this job.
Yeah, I don't want to do this, motherfuckers. But yeah, instead, no one's publishing this, though. So it's like, it's really kind of hard to cut through the fog on this.
My brain is so broken right now that I was like, oh, yeah, you wouldn't just go onto the internet and check
www.telegram.com/EugeneDebs.html.
How do I put in the Morse code for Eugene Debs into my Netscape?
How do I find your Yahoo page using I've already lost it. I'm already
trying
gone.
To ask Jeeves.
Excite joke. So when the train left Chicago, it only had room for three people. Eugene obviously was going to be one. His brother Theodore was the other. And the third was given to the person closest to Eugene in his life, his best buddy, Stephen Reynolds. For a quick reminder, Stephen was his socialist / hyper-communist friend from Terre Haute. And Stephen ended up getting the last seat as thanks for writing Eugene's biography just for the election. From what I could tell, Eugene didn't think it was really good writing, but, you know, you gotta have a book if you're running for president. Now, I'm sure you're wondering, where does Kate fit in all of this?
Oh.
Surely there's room in the sleeper car to be able to fit her. Well, sadly, no, because all of that space is taken up by floor-to-ceiling boxes of books, pamphlets, posters, and buttons.
Well, and also, I mean, this is a single gender cabin, people. Right. Come on. It's 1908.
God, we don't want people thinking Eugene is in a throuple. So the tenor of the campaign was made very clear on their first stop in Des Moines, Iowa. The Republicans had selected U.S. Secretary of War, which is what we used to call the Secretary of Defense, William Howard Taft of Ohio. But prior to being Secretary of War, he was a judge. Debs railed against Taft as being an anti-labor judge, which was kind of fair. If we're grading on a curve with other judges, Taft was kind of pro-labor. Like, he supported striking. He, you know, supported workman's comp to a certain degree. He didn't constantly fine for employers the entire time. So it's like, it was kind of a half and half. But if you're going to have a sticking point, sure, that's a good one. On the other side, the Democrats selected William Jennings Bryan for the third time in four elections. And to make things even easier for Debs, the Bryan campaign came up with this humdinger of a plan, stating that he was going to support workers and businesses equally.
Boo!
Worker centrism. Yeah, it's just an idea that's not gonna work. And based on some of the letters from Debs, it sounds like the Red Special was an absolute hit. According to him, every town they visited resulted in large crowds, and each stopping point for the night, which featured a speaking event for the campaign, was packed wall to wall. In some cases, supporters more rural areas would block the tracks and force the train to stop just so Eugene could step out and address them for a few minutes. The first half of the trip saw 5,000 people in attendance in Denver and 15,000 in San Diego. It sounds like his Los Angeles speech was also well attended, but Ray Ginger lists the speaking place as Spring Stadium, and I cannot find any record of a place called Spring Stadium existing in Los Angeles. So I really can't say how many people showed up.
There's a Spring Street in downtown LA. He
Oh
was
yeah, there
like,
is. I don't know if there's ever a stadium down there, but
yeah.
so even Gene was shocked by how popular the party had become and joked that the major parties would need a doctor and a preacher on standby when the votes were counted on election day.
Oh, okay. Okay, Gene, calm down.
No. This is gold. Golden jokes. Victor Berger, who was still very conservative about the whole thing, huge shock, personally predicted that the party would get 1.5 million votes, which would be more than 1.1 million votes than their last election.
Okay, that's sensible.
By the time that Eugene got to Spokane, Washington, he was mentally and physically wiped out. He'd been giving speeches every single day for a month, multiple times a day. His energy was so drained that it took all of his strength just to leave his bed. His chronic headaches increased, and he was constantly on the verge of losing his voice. And this ended up resulting in a bit of trickery that would be used for the second half of the trip. If it were dark enough and there were crowds around the train that they couldn't leave, Theodore would grab a big coat and a hat and wear the brim just low enough that no one could really see his face and go out there and start waving to the crowds. And Stephen Reynolds would then be like, "Oh, we're running late, so Eugene's not gonna speak, but thanks for coming by." And I assume Eugene was just too exhausted to stop them from doing this, which says a lot.
This poor guy.
So they did this for a few days, and by the time they got to Billings, Montana, Eugene had regained all of his strength and spoke to a crowd of 3,000 people. So the rest of the trip is just him, getting fairly large crowds. There were like 6,000 people in Minneapolis. But a bit of fun happened by the time they got to Duluth. So while they were out there selling books and pamphlets, Stephen's shitty biography of Eugene, and they had raised $2,000 just by selling books and pamphlets. The problem, though, is that they did not have a bank to put the money in during the trip.
No.
So they're hauling $2,000 on a poorly guarded train. And
No.
literally all that needs to happen is for like six thieves to find out about it. So they get into Duluth and they're like, okay, we have to put this in a bank. So Stephen and Theodore carry the money to the first bank they can find. They get denied. They go to another bank. They get denied. And they start to realize there probably aren't any banks in Duluth that are going to accept money from socialists.
Come on, green is green, motherfuckers.
Funny you say green because the $2,000 was all in coins.
Well, one that is so heavy. Two, what?
It was 200 pounds worth of coins that they're
That's why no one's taking it.
carrying around in money sacks, like cartoon ass money sacks. And you're 100% right. If I worked at a bank, because like coin counters didn't exist then, there isn't a
Yeah,
machine you could dump that shit in.
absolutely not.
Yeah. And so every single bank turned them down. And so Theodore and Stephen are lugging 200 pounds of coins around this tiny city all day long.
So now they've truly advertised how much money is on the train.
100%. And so they get back, and Eugene asks them why they brought the money back. They tell him what happened, and reportedly, Eugene laughed so hard that he fell down crying.
That's, yeah, man, me too.
Yeah. And maybe it's also a good way to make sure that you don't get robbed because, $2,000, pretty good amount of money. All in coins, I'm sure there's better options out there. On September 25th, the Red Special returned to Chicago as planned. The Debs campaign had traveled 9,000 miles, made 190 stops, and had spoken to 275,000 people. And then Eugene said, "Fuck it, let's do it live," and decided to keep going east. Gene and his small team planned a tour that would take them up to New York City and then back with the goal of getting into Terre Haute by Election Day. And once again, the tour ended up being a huge success. The crown jewel of this part of the trip in New York City, they sold 10,000 tickets to perform at the Hippodrome, which was considered to be, well, the builders called it the largest theater in the world, but they didn't really, do anything to verify that claim.
Sure,
But
yeah.
it was very much the largest theater in New York. The usual seating was 5,300 people,
Holy
but
shit.
the stage was so large that it held a two-ring circus.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And so I'm assuming those extra like 4,700 seats were on the stage.
Yeah.
Outside of the Hippodrome, scalpers were selling tickets for $5 a piece or $169 in today's money.
on. To see socialists. Come yeah, on now.
To see Eugene Debs talk about socialism. And so once Eugene took the stage, he had to wait 15 minutes because the audience would not stop cheering.
Hell yeah, that's a warm reception.
Absolutely, but this is an old man. His back hurts.
Just let him. How old is Eugene at this point?
Is 53, if I remember right.
Oh yeah, the man needs a nap. He's been going full throttle.
Give him a chair. So if this was the highlight, the low light came, as it so often does, in Camden, New Jersey. I had to look this up because I didn't know this term. He came down with the grip.
Oh, the grip. Isn't that like the flu? Or
yeah, it's exactly the flu. It's an old-timey word for the flu.
It's a French word for the flu.
Oh. Also, like the grippe.
Le grip.
That's so much better. So yeah, he ends up coming down with a very serious flu. And it was so bad, he had to cancel his speech in Newark, New Jersey. And after that, he just pretended that he was not sick for the remainder of the trip. From September to November, he just acted like he didn't have the flu and didn't treat it when he very much had the fucking flu for two
months. No, that's like me in the first few hours of COVID when I would get my shots and I'd fight and be like, no, I could totally put this proposal together. And I look back and it's like, what was I thinking?
Look, I would compare it, or at least from my point of view, after getting the first bag of steroids in the hospital, of just being like, I could punch the world. And that's essentially what he's doing this entire time. But I think he's running off the adrenaline of what ended up being another really big, big point in the campaign. So the campaign stops in Taft's hometown of Cincinnati, Ohio. And Eugene ends up getting a bigger crowd than Taft had gotten just days prior.
Suck it.
But to rub the salt even worse, Taft spoke for free. Eugene charged people 10 cents a ticket.
Oh, we making bills over here.
I don't know how. I don't know if this was planned or if it just happened. But the next day, both Taft and Eugene were in Evansville, Indiana, holding competing speeches. And once again, Taft got a larger crowd while charging 10 cents a piece than Taft got from anyone for speaking for free. That makes sense, right? He had a bigger crowd.
I think you said Taft both times.
Oh, I did. Yeah. So Eugene Debs outsold Taft again in Evansville, Illinois, and had a larger crowd than Taft, who was speaking for free.
Listen, you get what you pay for, am I right?
Yeah, and look, Taft was not exactly a charismatic man. He's not he's not remembered in the most kind of ways. But yeah, so I think between the two, I'd probably want to hear Eugene Debs speak over Taft, and I'd probably pay a dime. That sounds fine.
Add to those money bags.
Riding high on this, Eugene took the moment to invite Taft to speak at his next venue for 20 minutes before Eugene went on.
Hey, could you open for me?
Look, I think you need a leg up. I can help you out. I'll pay an experience.
I'll give you exposure.
Well, I mean, this was a trade offer that Taft could come and speak open for Eugene for 20 minutes if Eugene could open for Taft at Taft's next speaking engagement.
Boom.
And Taft declined, which I think is kind of a win, because to actually get an answer from Taft on that feels like a bigger thing than Taft just being like, who the fuck are you?
Yeah, fair enough.
By the time Eugene got to his next to last stop in Madison, Wisconsin, he was running on an optimistic high. Suddenly, a million votes actually seemed possible. The St. Louis Mirror predicted that Debs would walk away with 1.5 million votes, and that he stood a very real chance of winning in 1912. On election day, Eugene returned to Terre Haute and gave his last speech before going off to vote. His voice was nearly gone, and the flu that he had been fighting back since he was in New Jersey was finally starting to take over. But he still had enough strength to walk into the voting booth and vote for himself. As for the results, you know how we say nowadays that Twitter isn't real life?
Yeah.
The version of that then would be the Red Special isn't real life.
Yeah. I mean, I'm imagining a lot of that optimism was fueled by a fever.
Mm-hmm. When you're surrounded by thousands upon thousands of adoring fans, you end up saying that doom sentence that exists in theater and film. I think this might be really good.
Oh, no.
If you ever catch yourself saying that, just shut it down. You're done.
Yeah.
It's probably very bad. But yeah, so Eugene is running on this complete and total high, and it ends up not a ton of people show up in the polls. In total, Eugene got 421,000 votes, only 8,000 more than he won in 1904. Now, that said, there was a bit of fuckiness. In Gene's hometown, Terre Haute, he officially didn't get any votes, despite the fact that he knew at least he voted for himself.
Well, I mean, to be fair, Kate's not voting for him because she legally can't.
Right, right. So, as is tradition nowadays, you immediately call the election rigged and you sue a secretary of state or a lieutenant governor. You know, mm-hmm. you get your money from that as you can and you move on. Gene, being himself, was a lot more level-headed because Terre Haute was using this newfangled thing called a voting machine for the first time.
No, it was Dominion the whole time.
Yeah, ye olde Dominion with their clank fucking kerchunker voting machine. And he was just like, I understand. It's your first time using these voting machines. That was probably the problem.
Look at thine Chad.
Oh my God. Use a drill press when you vote next time. Anyway, so yeah, he attributes it to a mistake just using new voting machines and moves on. However, this wouldn't stop other socialists from spreading the rumor that the major parties purposely reported fewer votes for the party than they actually got. So once again, another way that Eugene is kind of losing control of his own party. However, the 1908 election wasn't a total loss. Eugene did get 3% of the vote nationwide, and he got nearly 9% of the vote in Nevada, Montana, and Oklahoma. But it was local elections where the Socialist Party really shined. In one election, they jumped from 18 elected positions to 38. And this included 6 mayoral races in Boone, Iowa, Brainerd, Minnesota, Eureka, Utah, Grand Junction, Colorado, Medford, Oregon, and Winslow, Arkansas.
Hey, good job, guys.
I mean, all places I'm pretty sure nowadays would be like, we elected a socialist when? What?
Right.
As for Eugene, he was very sick for a month. Now that he actually has to face the flu or
leg
in the face. Yeah.
He's lucky he didn't turn into pneumonia.
Yeah. I didn't put this in at the right point. This does end up leading to him having to have a second throat surgery. But not only that, but his rheumatism and lower back pain were even worse than before. Apparently when he spoke, he did a lot of like stooping and like bending at the waist to like talk to people who were lower than him than when he was on a podium, which led to his lower back getting fucked up.
Oh my God. Right. Cause yoga had not been invented in the continental US yet.
Yes. Crunchy wine moms had not invented yoga yet. However, thanks to Kate's begging, Eugene did not just immediately go off on a speaking tour and just pretend he wasn't sick. Kind of stayed home.
Great.
Still did speaking engagements. At the time, he was writing 3 to 4 articles a week for a socialist paper called Appeal to Reason. Weirdly enough, he wanted to go into the office for Appeal to Reason most of the time. And their office was in a small town of Girard, Kansas.
That's nowhere near Terre Haute.
Yeah. So he spends a lot of time in Girard, Kansas and just leaves Kate alone in fucking Terre Haute. So that's how he ends up spending 1909, mostly based on things he's done before. A very chill year for Gene.
Truly, yes.
But now it's 1910. New year, old me, am I right? Eugene prepared to begin a new speaking tour. And at the end of January, before he left, he got the flu again. But rather than cancel the tour, he got on a train to Chicago and did the whole run while secretly being horrifically sick.
Oh!
He also gave away his entire tour per diem in one day and had to wire people for more money.
What happened to the bags of money?
Oh, that went straight to the party. That's not Gene's, that's the party's. Had to go to pay for the train for the red paint full of lead.
Yes.
By the spring, Eugene had recovered from the flu, just in time for a whole new round of factional arguing within his own party. And of course, it was fighting between the left and the right. On the left, you still had the anarcho-syndicalists of Big Bill Haywood. On the right is Victor Berger and company. But most recently for Berger's faction, they had given up on the idea of converting members of the AFL and set their new sights on working with leaders of the labor movement, even if they weren't socialists. People against this faction argued that this would lead to more concessions for capitalism and eventually lead to the failure of the movement. As for Eugene, according to Ray Ginger at least, he was friends with people in both factions and once again could not bring himself to publicly take a side. He didn't want to talk shit about Bill Hayward. He didn't want to talk shit about Victor Berger. And ultimately, he ended up being a centrist, kind of saying shitty things about both, but nothing that would really give people any idea about which side he really wanted.
Oh.
And once again, as is tradition, it being 1910, it's a convention year, and Eugene did not go because he felt it was appropriate for him to tip the scales. The problem, though, was that the right wing of the party was getting very good at getting their preferred candidates elected as delegates for each national convention, which means as their power grew, the more likely it was to move the party towards their preferred theory. As workers in the party noticed this, they kind of started to get crestfallen and realize that, you know, they don't have the time or money to really put towards political action, especially in a party system. So a lot of workers left the party and they were replaced by intellectuals.
No!
The party met in Chicago, as is tradition, in May of 1910. And like I said, Debs didn't attend, which means he missed out on the right wing of the party setting the policy for the next 2 years. One such policy was pushing for a restriction on all immigration from Asia. It was put forward by Victor Berger.
Right.
And the exact wording that Berger used was a lot more racist than the terms I'm going to use.
Great.
But it was also Berger's attempt to try to keep wooing the AFL, who had been fighting for a full ban on Asian immigration for fucking years. So fun, and by fun I mean fucked up fact, the Chinese Exclusion Act had already been on the books since 1882. The law banned immigration from China on a 10-year basis, but gave exceptions for diplomats, teachers, students, merchants, and travelers. This didn't stop immigration from China from happening, but it did make it very illegal. The law was re-upped in 1892 and then made permanent in 1902. So the extra bit of banning immigration from China seems to be pushing for an outright ban of everyone. And this bill did not get repealed until 1943, when the Magnuson Act allowed 105 Chinese immigrants to enter the U.S. each year.
Holy cow.
Yeah, so Victor Berger's first move is just to just be like, hey, this racist law we made back in the 1800s should be more racist, and I'm doing it, so Senpai notices me. Woo. So Gene found out about this while he was away from the convention, and he immediately sent a telegram calling the ban, quote, unsocialistic, reactionary, outrageous, and entirely consistent in a convention of self-seekers. If socialism does not stand staunchly, unflinchingly, and uncompromisingly for the working class and for the exploited and oppressive masses of all lands, then it stands for none, and its claim is a false pretense, and its profession a delusion and a snare. Very fiery stuff. It arrived late and was not read at the convention.
Come on!
So the immigration ban policy would get a touch watered down thanks to Morris Hillquit, who didn't so much negotiate better policy, but just kind of a glow up of better wording. So instead, the convention agreed to oppose immigration bans that were solely on the base of race, but they did support immigration bans if they were done to control the number of workers entering the country. So as long as you give a reason, we'll support it.
Right. It's like, I mean, there have also been a lot of Irish heading to San Francisco after the earthquake, and mm-hmm. we don't like them either. Why stop at race?
It's extraordinarily fucked up that a lot of first-generation German immigrants who had difficulty finding work and were definitely discriminated from the populace at large are just like, well, we got ours, so fuck you.
Listen, what's more American than pulling the ladder up behind you?
It's, yeah. Yeah. So on top of this, the right wing also agreed that the party wouldn't take a stance on trade unions versus industrial unions, which again was a huge win and a favor done for the AFL. It probably also didn't help that a delegate made the pitch to cast aside trade unions because they were regularly white only, and the only way to fight for Black Americans was to support industrial unionism, and of course Victor Berger was going to strike that down. So reps of the left wing called this decision, quote, a betrayal of the cause of the working class. And Victor Berger did not care, because pretty much the party was his at this point. But all isn't horrific in 1910, because now Eugene and Kate had a foster son. A 10-year-old Oscar Bauer Jr. came to live with the Debses after Kate's sister suddenly died, leaving Oscar orphaned. Kate at first did not deal with it well. So a bit of a reminder with Kate. She has been left alone at home so much, she has to try to figure out how to fill her days. There's no internet, there's no TV, women are allowed to do essentially nothing. So she just starts cleaning the house to the point that some rooms are cleaned multiple times a day. And so now you're introducing a 10-year-old child to someone who has essentially become obsessed with cleanliness.
Yeah, who just lost his mom, who happened to be the sister.
Mm-hmm. And so now she has to look after a tween dealing with the sudden deaths of his parents. Plus, therapy was about as old as Oscar was at this point, so all that internal child anger had nowhere to go. And Kate gets to be the person home alone to deal with it. So Eugene did the thing that he usually did in their relationship, and he made things worse. And by doing that, I mean he got a fox terrier by the name of Buster for Oscar. For those of you who don't have terriers, let me fill you in on my life.
They cray.
Oh yeah, they are the best dogs in the goddamn world, but they bark in a way that defies acoustics. It's like a dart in your eardrum.
Yep.
Occasionally they will fart in your mouth if they're yelling at someone outside. Joyous. They have a metric fuck ton of energy. They are smart in ways that are kind of unsettling.
Yeah.
Which means they take a lot of time and focus to train.
Mm-hmm.
So Ray Ginger doesn't go into much further details, but with Eugene gone for months at a time, and Kate now having to deal with a child and a dog all at once, I don't know how she didn't just start punching everything. And on top of all of this, Eugene has taken up a new hobby because he likes going on forest walks with the dog. And he starts foraging for mushrooms that he leaves in the attic.
What? What?
I don't know how she hasn't murdered this man yet. It's wild. It's fucking wild. The Socialist Party would also get a pair of historic wins in the 1910 midterms. A man by the name of Emil Seidel would win the race to become mayor of Milwaukee, making it the largest city that they held a mayoral seat. And Victor fucking Berger became the party's first ever U.S. congressman.
Whoa!
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. So in private, Eugene was incapable of celebrating the new high mark for the party. There are not a few members who regard vote getting as of supreme importance, no matter by what methods the votes are secured. And this leads them to hold out inducements and make representations which are not at all compatible with the stern and uncompromising spirit of a revolutionary party. And by this point, Eugene wanted these intellectuals who had taken over the party to step down so the workers they were intended to help could run things. I'm sure they will like this idea. And once again, Eugene chose not to go to the 1912 convention to express these ideas. Instead, he spent all of 1911 speaking and writing about what he thought was best and felt that if he made his point appropriately, either the leaders of the party and the people that followed Victor Berger would see the fault in their stars and step down.
Oh, you sweet, innocent child.
Or would get voted out. For a change of pace, this convention was held in Indianapolis. And once again, the conservatives held the majority and had no intention of stepping down. Frankly, it was very foolish to think that they would, because for the past decade, they had worked hard to control local party apparatuses and newspapers. They controlled the rules and delegate nominations to the point that workers left when they realized that they never had a chance to exert their own wishes, let alone win. These vacancies were filled by intellectual reformers, and the party was solidly in control of the right wing at this point. At the convention, Big Bill Haywood recognized the left wing was outnumbered, so he got to work to make sure they weren't outmatched. On the first day, the right wing pushed to endorse the AFL, but instead they took a surprising loss when delegates supported endorsing the concept of industrial unionization, but no particular union. The left followed this up by getting a left-winger nominated to be the chairman of the entire convention. Sensing that things were about to go suddenly very sideways, Victor Berger introduced a new amendment to the party constitution. Quote, any member of the party who opposes political action or advocates crime, sabotage, or other methods of violence as a weapon of the working class to aid in its emancipation shall be expelled from party membership. So there are two reasons that this is a particularly wild thing to throw down. For one, Eugene Debs fully supported sabotage as a way to punish capitalists who refused to bargain.
Yay!
Yeah. He had spoken before, like, fuck up the machinery, purposely go slow. Just, you know, don't hurt anyone, but yeah, I mean, do what you gotta do to get their attention. The other was that violence amongst socialists and anarchists had become a bit of a cudgel in the press. 2 years prior, the Los Angeles Times was bombed. 21 people were killed and over 100 were injured. And the anti-union head of the paper essentially claimed that all union members were terrorists. And obviously it was socialists who had done the bombing. Socialists and unions immediately struck back, claiming that the guy running the paper was just anti-union. They was just like, making these wild accusations to make them look bad. And then the next day, police arrested two socialists for the bombing.
Damn it.
It was a pair of brothers, the McNamara brothers. They ended up getting Clarence Darrow and Lincoln Steffens to be their lawyers. But from my understanding, the case against them was so airtight that they definitely did it, that Clarence Darrow recommended that they plead guilty and hope for clemency.
Yeah.
And if Clarence Darrow is telling you that, you probably should.
You fucked.
Yeah. So they pled guilty, and nearly every union and socialist leader immediately printed denouncements of the two men, throwing them under the bus. Except for Eugene Debs, who argued these people aren't socialists, they're Catholics.
I'm sorry, what?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember Eugene does not like religion. Still a fucked up thing to say at the time, but...
Well, I mean, it's always safe to blame the Catholics if it's the 1900s.
Look, we've been blaming the Catholics since the 1810s. We're, you know, might as well keep it going. But he did make the counter argument of, like, even if they are Catholics, the people who died in this bombing were all workers. None of the management or ownership died. So obviously these aren't union supporters and they're not socialists if they're killing workers, which probably should have been his entire argument.
Right. You could. Yeah, that's enough.
Yeah. But the thing is, you know, once that had happened and then the socialists and union leaders had to go back on their, you know, their knee jerk thing of saying, obviously this wasn't us. And then it was, you know, it became proof positive for a lot of people that socialists and union workers were anarchists and terrorists. So by presenting this as a new amendment in the party constitution, if you voted against it, you were just proving these people right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of the people on the left are people who are like, no, you sabotage business. You do whatever you can to get your fucking rights.
Right.
But by introducing this, the right was able to get things back on track and the amendment passed 191-90. And with this new momentum, Berger and the right wing moved to ensure that Eugene Debs did not get the nomination to run for president. And I'm going to say it again for the people in the back. Eugene does not want the fucking job at all. In fact, he had spent the previous year trying to trick Fred Warren, the editor-in-chief of Appeals to Reason, to run for president instead.
I kept writing these articles.
Funny story. So when Eugene was in Girard, there was a moment where Fred Warren was off, I believe, on a trial. I cannot remember what for, but it was a long trial. So he and a fellow guy by the name of Julius Wayland put together a secret edition of Appeals to Reason that were just full of letters from people asking Fred Warren to run for president. And that was the whole edition. Fred got back before they could release it and immediately told him to throw it away and made them do the whole magazine over again in one night.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So Fred is not running for president. Unfortunately for Eugene, the regional right-wing factions could not unify behind a single candidate. The Milwaukee and Chicago rightists nominated brand new mayor of Milwaukee, Emil Seidel, and the New York City right-wingers wanted journalist Charles Edward Russell. And on the first ballot, Eugene won 165 votes, good enough for 60%, and the nomination.
You burnt.
But as a consolation prize, Emil Seidel is elected for vice president.
Of course.
For this election, Eugene took a bit of a different tact. 1908 had completely destroyed his body and throat, and he had little to show for it. For the summer, he decided what he was going to do is chill at home, save up his energy, and then in the fall, he would go out and campaign as hard as he could. And he stuck to this for about a month, and then kicked off his campaign in St. Louis on June 29th. I don't know how this man ever had a doctor.
I don't know how he's still alive.
It really defies logic. The 1912 election, I will say, is something that we will have to do our own episode on, because this election was buck wild. The main Cliff's Notes I can do is William Howard Taft was Theodore Roosevelt's choice to run for president. Taft won. Roosevelt was excited. Within like a few months, Taft started doing stuff that Roosevelt didn't like. And so Roosevelt was just mocking him and making fun of him ruthlessly throughout his entire term, to the point that Roosevelt decided, fuck you, I'm going to run the Republican primary. Step the fuck down. But Taft is an incumbent president, and it looks bad when you don't renominate your incumbent. So Taft gets it. Roosevelt's pissed. And so he starts his own third party, the Progressive Party, or as it was more colloquially known, the Bull Moose Party.
That's right.
A lot of wacky, weird stuff happens during that. But the long and short of it is this is both good and bad news for the socialists. The good is that the incumbent vote was now split. Taft and Roosevelt were only focusing on each other the entire time, giving a wide open lane to any challengers not in their crosshairs. The bad was that Roosevelt in particular had taken up quite a few of the more progressive reforms of the Socialist Party, which would cut into their potential normie vote. Before this election, Eugene could only truly rely on the votes of full-tilt socialists. Gene ditched the gimmick of the Red Special and just took to large-scale speeches, which people did have to pay to attend. In Philadelphia, Gene drew a crowd of 18,000 people and raised $2,700 or $86,000 in today's money.
Wow.
In New York City, he packed Madison Square Garden with 13,000 people and received a 10-minute standing ovation.
Wow.
It was estimated the speech brought in about $10,000 or $320,000 in today's money.
Ooh.
The party, which had overestimated how well things would go in 1908, set their hopes high with the expectation that Eugene would net 2 million votes this time. Nowhere near enough to win, but a very respectable showing. And again, though, this would be far too high of an expectation. Roosevelt had siphoned off a ton of votes and embarrassed the incumbent President Taft with a third place finish. And their fighting paved the way for Democrat Woodrow Wilson to win with 41% of the vote.
God damn it.
As for Gene, he got 901,000 votes, or 6% of the national total. And the thing is, if they had never thrown out that 2 million number, this would have been a huge showing for the party that they could be very proud of.
Yeah.
Not only did they double their numbers, they got 16.5% of the vote in Nevada, 16.4% of the vote in Oklahoma, and 13.6% of the vote in Montana. Eugene even beat the incumbent president in California, Mississippi, Louisiana, Florida, Arizona, and Nevada. But that 6% didn't result in any electoral votes, and he came in fourth place. Following the election, something in Debs' personality and demeanor started to change. I've been waiting for this moment.
And the shoe to drop.
I was starting to believe it wouldn't.
Oh, no.
All right. So at this point, he's in his late 50s. He's racked with chronic pain all over his body. So a change in demeanor really isn't that surprising.
Mm-hmm.
But according to Ray Ginger, Gene started to grow somewhat, I suppose, jaded is probably the best word for it. Part of this was due. Oh, yeah. So just a heads up. This is the time to bow out of the, you know.
Trigger warning.
Yeah. So we'll see you next week. If not, you gotta go. So part of this was due to the recent suicide of one of his closest socialist colleagues, Julius Wayland. The two were very, very close, but repeatedly got into arguments over Eugene giving away literally everything he had to anyone who even slightly asked. I will say we have been making fun of Gene for this, but Julius's argument is kind of shit. because after that moment where Eugene had given away his per diem on the entire tour, he stopped in Girard, Kansas, and waiting there was Julius. And Julius just lays into him and he's like, if you even gave half of the money that you give away to personal charity to the movement, we would be so much farther ahead right now. And finished up by saying, these people who are taking your charity are already doomed. Let hell take them.
I mean, buddy, you didn't have to sentence these people to damnation.
I know, right? It's like, I don't know why they're all going to hell, but okay.
Yeah.
And Eugene admitted, yeah, you're probably right, but I can't stop. I'm never going to be, even if he tried, he wouldn't be able to stop. There's another story about Eugene talking to a guy in Terre Haute. He's like, last week was very cold and I saw you without your coat. And the guy was like, I was fine without my coat. I own a coat. And Gene's like, no, take my coat. Take it now. And would not let up until the guy took his coat.
Guy's just probably like, I have a coat. Want this.
I just deal well in the cold, Gene. Come on.
Yeah, I run hot. This doesn't even fit me.
It was a short walk. I didn't. Fuck. Now I have a long coat. So knowing this, they were still like really, really good friends who occasionally got into a knockdown dragout fight about one thing. So this in particular made Julius Wayland's suicide note in particular really fucking gutting. It simply said, quote, the struggle under the capitalist system isn't worth the effort. Let it pass. Yeah. I should also note that at this time, Julius was kind of, from what I can understand, was being accused of having sex with a sex worker. But Ray Ginger does present a number of things that make this seem difficult to believe. For one, Julius was extraordinarily prudish, which, you know, now could also be a proof of it too, because people who tend to be very hyper in one regard are very different. The other was that he was still very much mourning his wife, who had died in a my God. So the year prior, they were driving their horseless carriage or automobile about 20 miles an hour, and while Julius was driving it, the steering wheel came off.
Oh God!
And they crashed into a telephone pole, which threw his wife from the car.
Holy shit!
Yeah, and so she ends up dying, and so he's in just a deep depressive mourning during this whole time. But it was one of those things that, whether what he did was true or not, the press was going to use this against one of the biggest names in the socialist movement. And so he, not great.
Oh.
The other side of Eugene's change was, in my opinion, the effect of constantly campaigning. When he's out campaigning, he's speaking in this very big oratory sort of style with just, you know, he's practiced his speeches so much that it's just how he talks. And he's been doing it for so long that now when he's sitting down with people and talking one-on-one in private, he's speaking like he's giving a speech. And people are finding it very fucking annoying.
Right. Can't turn it off.
At one point, a young socialist asked him, "Who do you think I am? 500 people?"
Yeah. Ugh.
He also starts to take the theory of it being okay if he's generally correct about things. Like, he doesn't, you know, he doesn't need to be exactly correct. He doesn't need to have exact statistics or proof behind the thing he says. As long as he's generally in the ballpark of right, that's now good enough.
No, our woke bae is becoming just another dude.
And on top of this, I don't know how it took this long, but Kate is at a breaking point. And it's actually not because Eugene has abandoned her to a house with an angry child and a loud dog. It is because every time Eugene comes back from his long trips, his health is horrific and it's getting worse and worse after each campaign. And he has even less to show for it after each campaign because the right wing of the party is taking it over no matter what he fucking does. She's often quoted as saying to friends, "Gene is killing himself for people who do not appreciate it." In the summer of 1913, Eugene decides to go on vacation for a couple months in Estes Park, Colorado. He does not bring Kate, or his stepson, right. Or his dog, or a friend of the family he'd recently taken in after she was arrested for sex work. They all get to live in the house in Terre Haute and get to be Kate's problem still.
Okay.
God damn it. That's not important. What is important is that it gave time for Eugene to think. He finally paid off the $22,000 of debt that he'd taken on with the American Railway Union about a decade and a half prior, and his desire to write 3 articles a week had waned, understandably. Kate had brought up to him that he could still write occasionally, and selling those pieces would be more than enough for the family to live on. So Gene decided to retire from union work, from politics, from speaking, from nearly everything except the occasional piece he would write. And you know, he might have actually done that for a long period of time if it wasn't for one thing.
Oh no, what?
Some fucking asshole named Gavrilo shooting Franz Ferdinand in the fucking head.
What?
Yep.
World War I?
World War fucking I. And in the next episode, the final chapter of Eugene Debs, we're going to talk about how World War I brought this guy back from the brink to, you know, run it back one more fucking time to really give it his last fucking go. I haven't finished the biography, so I don't know how how this is going to affect his health. I assume bad. It's not going to be great.
Yeah. God, every time he thinks he's out, they pull him back in.
I definitely know some spoilers. The party does keep fighting.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's socialism in America. What do you fucking expect?
Damn it.
But yeah, that's the end of that part of the story. Thoughts, feelings, questions?
I mean, yeah, I'm adrift thinking about his and Kate's marriage. Is it even legally still a marriage?
Like, Kate deserves so fucking much at this point. One thing I did leave out is in 1910, she wrote an article for Appeals to Reason supporting the suffragette movement, but I couldn't find much beyond that article of her really kind of doing that kind of work. So it's like, I don't know what she's doing during this time when she's just being completely left alone, especially now that there's a kid, a dog, a long-term guest that's like obviously scared of the cops.
I'm choosing to believe they all found love and found family together. I'm choosing to believe that.
I hope so too. But yeah, we're going to cover that next time. We have at least one more presidential election for Gene. At least one more. It's probably going to go long because there's like a lot of what's the word I'm looking for? A lot of epilogues for folks. We got to talk about. We got to talk about Gene. What happened to Kate? What happens to Theodore?
Yeah.
Why does he now look like Freddy Krueger without the makeup?
Oh no.
I mean, he just looks like Robert Englund to me. What happens to their stepson at this point? Victor Berger, what happens to that fucking prick? And what happens to the Socialist Party? Does it survive? Probably not. Either which way, a lot of questions I need to answer in 2 weeks.
Hey!
Yeah, we'll see you next time here on Gadfly. Gadfly is a production of Added Serotonin. Our episodes are edited by Brianna Valentine of Rem Alternus Productions. Our theme song is Sophomore Makeout by Silent Partner, and you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at GadflyPod.
Ready to level up your cosplay game? Check out the Geek Forge on Etsy. With a variety of props to give your photos that extra spark, you'll find just what you need. Hold magical fire in the palm of your hand, or take a potion to restore your mana. With a large variety of colors, you can choose your own magical flavor for your cosplay. Bring drama to your photo shoots with these vibrant props and more, all available at the Geek Forge. Are you ready to level up your cosplay?